da 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 da.
Vayidaber Adonai el Moshe le'emor, Pinchas ben Elazar, ben Aharon ha-Kohen, Heishiv eschamasi, me'al b'nei Yisrael, Bekano eskinasi besocham, v'lo chilis yes b'nei Yisrael, bekinasi lachein emor, Hineni nosein lo esberisi shalom. And Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aharon HaKohen, has assuaged, turned back my anger on the people of Israel when he jealously slash zealously stood up for my honor among them. And I will not destroy, I did not destroy the people of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore, say, I hereby give him my covenant of shalom, peace.
Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Come right over. Ah, you're here. Good. Take the easy chair by the window. Comfortable?
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. Or should I say this week, Pinchas Chernofsky. And this show is for Shivasar B'Tammuz and Parshat Pinchas. Recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, the 17th of Tammuz, 5780, corresponding this year to July 9th. The policy that I have followed all these years is during the Omer and during the 3 weeks, only a cappella music. Excuse me. And the opening clip of music, if you listen carefully, had no instrumentation, and neither will the songs that I will be playing. Without further ado, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim kraticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tichyena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Imavono tishmoria Adonai miya amod, ki imecha haslicha l'ma'an tivare. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzara v'ashivya, ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha-makom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha, ומאפלה לאורה, ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב, ונאמר אמן. יהי רצון שתשלח מהירה רפואה שלמה מן השמיים, רפואת הנפש ורפואת הגוף, לחולי קורונה, בארץ, בעם היהודי ובעולם. Here is an a cappella version of Achenu by Shauli.
La 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 Achenu Kol Beis Yisrael Hanesunim Batzohara Uvashivyo Hoimdi Bayo la 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 Bashidio Ho Hoi Midi Behin Bayo Uvein Hayah Bosho Hamakoyim Yirachim Yirachim Maliyim Yoytiyem Yitzahra Yirvacha Umeafi lo li ohira Umishibud Bigiyula Hamakoyim Yirachim
Name Pinchas, and it is used by people that I know, both Hebrew speakers as well as English speakers. In fact, it's interesting to note that some of the English-speaking friends I have call me Pinchas, and some of the Israelis that I know call me Phil. But that's neither here nor there. The correct pronunciation of the name Pinchas is P. Nechas. The Nun has a Shva under it, which is a Shva Na. It does not belong to the first syllable, which is P. It belongs to the second syllable, Nechas. P. Nechas. Notwithstanding that, people whose names are Pinchas refer to themselves as Pinchas, and the Sedra this week as Parshat Pinchas. And that's mostly a result of a background of English speaking where many, many words, most words, are pronounced on the first syllable. And when you are talking English and referring to this week's Sedra, you are more likely, as a native English speaker, to say Pinchas. A, that's a mistake. B, it accents the wrong syllable. And yet that's how it has crept in to what's known as Yeshivish, which is English with a heavy dose of Hebrew words that have been sort of rendered in English pronunciation, not English translation. Nobody says this week's portion is Phineas, but to call it Parshat Pinchas is very common. Again, I say from English-speaking background people. The name, since it's mine, I have checked into this, occurs 25 times in Tanakh, most of them referring to Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen, as in this week's Sedra and the name of the Sedra. And some of them refer to Pinchas, the son of Eli HaKohen. He with his brother Hophni were not very proper Kohanim. They took advantage of people bringing korbanot. And only once that the name is spelled without a yud happens to be not referring to Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen, but referring to Hophni and Pinchas. But that's only once. Many times it's with a yud there, and all the times it's a yud for Pinchas ben Elazar. Now, the only theory that I have as to why it is so common to have dropped the yud is that in this week's Sedra, in the name of the Sedra, in a Sefer Torah, the word Pinchas is written with a tiny yud. A yud is the smallest of the letters in the first place. And the scribal tradition is to write it even smaller. I suspect that might be a contributing factor to the drop of the yud. But I checked my great-grandfather's, Matseva, and it spells Pinchas, for whom I am named, Pei Nun Chet Samach, and that's how I spell my name. If I had to do it all over, I would probably put the Yud in, but if I really had to do it all over, I would probably not be called Pinchas at all, but Yisrael, since I was born 3 days before the State of Israel was declared, and my brit was already after the name Medinat Yisrael. And I once asked my father how come he didn't name me Yisrael. And he shrugged and he said that his father's father was Pinchas, and he wanted to give that name, but if I want to adopt a middle name, I could take Yisrael. I haven't officially taken it, but it always remains a question mark in my name background. Enough of that. Shivasar Batamuz is one of the four fast days marking and commemorating and mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. The four of them have attached to them each a different part of the process of destruction, from the beginning of the siege around Jerusalem in the time of the Babylonian reign, and that's Asara B'Tevet, and the breach of the wall, which is marked on Shivasar B'Tamuz, even though according to the Navi it happened on the 9th of Tammuz. That's another story. And then the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash itself on Tisha B'Av, and then what is poetically referred to as the extinguishing of the last glowing ember of Jewish presence in Israel is marked on Tzom Gedalia with the assassination of the Jewish autonomous governor, Gedalia ben Achikam, who was knocked off by relatives, and that gave an excuse to just kill more Jews and exile all the rest. Shivasar Batamuz, though, the Mishnah says in Ta'anit that there were five tragedies, calamities, associated with Shivasar Batamuz. Four of them are related in some way, significant way, to Churban Beit HaMikdash, the destruction. And the first one predates that by a long time. The four, even though that's second, third, fourth, and fifth in the Mishnah, I will start with, it is the cessation of the daily Temidim, the daily sacrifices, which had miraculously, with God's help, continued through 2.5 years of siege, and on Shivasar Batamuz, which also marks the breach of Yerushalayim, the Korban Tamid stopped. There were no more lambs available to us to bring them, and that was itself a tragedy, as declared by the Mishnah, even though it is connected to the whole process of destruction. The event itself of not having any more this unbroken chain of connection to Har Sinai. The Torah tells us in this week's Sedra of Pinchas, and we quote it in the Korbanot part of the davening every morning, that the daily sacrifices were Olat Tamid Ho'asuya Bahar Sinai. They were a constant burnt offering, complete offering, which came from Har Sinai, that was made in Har Sinai. That reference gives some of the commentaries the opening to make the following observation. Ma'amad Har Sinai, the Sinai experience itself, was one day, which we commemorate on Shavuot. Moshe Rabbeinu's part in the Sinai process continued for 40 days and 40 nights. But what continued on an ongoing basis for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years was the daily Temidim that were made at Har Sinai. I mentioned the breach of Yerushalayim. The Nabi says that in the first Beit HaMikdash it happened on the 9th of Tammuz, in the second Beit HaMikdash on the 17th. We observe it, we commemorate it on the 17th, A, because there are other things that we mark on that same day, B, because Chazal, our sages, did not want to overload us with fast days. One in Tammuz is enough. And also because the exile that has followed the second Beit HaMikdash has been much, 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 much longer than the exile period following the first Beit HaMikdash and the beginning building of the second. So the loss of the second Beit HaMikdash is more poignant for us, having so many years since it stood, and therefore the Yud Zayin Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, was chosen. Second Beit HaMikdash lasted 10 years longer than the first Beit HaMikdash, 420 to 410 years, and beauty-wise, the second Beit HaMikdash was a magnificent physical structure, and that loss hits people in the heart sometimes maybe more than the less ostentatious and more holy first Beit HaMikdash. One way or the other, that's Shivasar Batamuz. The other two events, the last two events, are the burning of a Sefer Torah by Apustamos and the erection of a pagan idol in the Beit HaMikdash. So that those four are all related in some way to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. But the Mishnah, when it's counting the five calamities, starts at an earlier point. It starts with Chet Ha'egel, the sin of the golden calf. It does not identify that in a straightforward manner. It says that on the 17th of Tammuz, Nishtabru Haluchot, the tablets were broken. It doesn't even say Moshe Rabbeinu broke the tablets, which he did. It just says Nishtabru Haluchot, and that is a tragedy which we mourn. However, the breaking of the tablets was in the definitely the follow-through, follow-up, that's not the right word either, of the sin of the golden calf, because when Moshe descended Har Sinai with the two luchot that God had written, the Aseret HaDibrot, when he saw the frolicking, reveling with the golden calf, he either dropped them or intentionally smashed them so that he would not subject Israel to the inescapable conclusion that they knew what they were doing, and here's the proof in the Ten Commandments, which they heard at Sinai, that you're not allowed to make any images before me. And they would have been not able to be argued for to save them. But by breaking the Luchot, Moshe Rabbeinu was able to say, well, you know, that was 40 days ago, and they heard it, and they were nervous on that day, and very scared on that day. And it was a powerful experience that, and they didn't have a concrete copy of the Decalogue. And also to be able to say to God, you want to punish them, you have to punish me. I broke the Luchot, which you wrote. So that was a bargaining position of Moshe, who then was able to say to God, if you kill the people, you will be violating your promises to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And you will be opening the mouth of other countries and other people, and they will say God might have been strong enough to take them out of Egypt, but obviously he wasn't strong enough to sustain them in the Midbar. And that would be a desecration of your name, says Moshe to God. And Moshe, God's response is, Vayinachem hara'a, Asher Diber Lasot Liamo, he regretted the bad that he had announced that he was going to do to Bnei Israel. Now, starting the tone of this fast, which has been going on for a long, long time, with an event that predated the Beit HaMikdash by many, many years. It predated the building of the Mishkan by a couple of months. And it gives us a starting point to see what went wrong with us. So if you look up the reasons for the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, and the reasons for the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, you really have to also look up the reasons for the sin of the golden calf. And you see there lessons to be learned and behavior to shun and change for the positive. And that becomes a challenge that is more encompassing. And Tisha B'Av has the same idea with the four events related more or less to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And the first one on the list of five is Chet HaMeraglim, which happened on Tisha B'Av. The way the Mishnah puts it is that was the date that the generation of adult males in the wilderness were declared not to enter Eretz Yisrael and to roam around and die out over the period of 40 years. And that is a calamity which set the tone for the tragic nature of Tisha B'Av, which we'll talk about more when we get closer to it. So that's Shivasar B'Tammuz. Now there's another thing that we all need to realize. In the Torah, there is one fast day. That one fast day, of course, is Yom Kippur. Period. And therefore, anything that would be called a fast day of a rabbinic creation should be modeled after Yom Kippur, because that is the only model that we have for a fast day. So what happened was that when the four fast days were declared for the process of the Churban, all of them were originally full Yom Kippur-like fast days. And during the tenure of the second Beit HaMikdash, Tisha B'Av was sort of suspended, and the other three fast days were canceled. Now there's a difference. After the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, Tisha B'Av was reinstated, and that is why to this very day it is a full Yom Kippur-like fast day. The other three fast days originally were made after the second Beit HaMikdash, were made depending upon the quality of life of the Jews in their communities of exile. Jews who lived in a country where they were treated properly and not persecuted or discriminated against did not fast on those 3 days. Asar B'Tevet, Shivasar B'Tammuz, and Tzom Gedalia. Jews who lived in situations of Gahak Tzaras, with oppression and persecution, had to fast those 3 fast days full, just like Tisha B'Av. And then, sometime later, I don't know when it happened, the body of the rabbinate, whatever that means at the time, decided that the fast days would no longer be dependent on the community or optional in any way. They would be required, but they felt that enough time had passed since the original declaration of these fast days and the cancellation of these three that it wouldn't be fair to impose them in full style. So they took their rabbinic license, so to speak, and said, okay, we reinstitute required, not relative to anything that goes on, the fasting of Tzom Gedalia and of Asar B'Tevet and of Shivasar B'Tammuz. However, we will build in leniencies. For example, the fast will not begin at sunset the night before, but will begin only at dawn. The fact of the matter is, with the ability to eat last night and even up to 4:15 this morning in Israel, if one wanted to, made the fasting of today, even though it's over at 8:18 in Israel and 8:44 on the east coast of the United States. I don't know, you know, if it varies in other places. And at 10:07 in London. I did look up also Melbourne, Australia, where the fast ends at 5:48. So, point in favor of the Southern Hemisphere, but we get them back on Asar B'Tevet anyway. So, you have the leniency of the fast being from dawn until stars out. That's a big leniency. you have the prohibition of only eating and drinking, and not the other three categories of prohibition that belong to Yom Kippur, the model fast from the Torah, and to Tisha B'Av, a rabbinic fast which copied the style, the format of fasting from Yom Kippur. And that would be rechitza, bathing and washing, the use of lotions and cosmetics, the wearing of leather shoes, and marital relations. Those are not forbidden on the other three fast days, but only on Tisha B'Av and, of course, Yom Kippur. The next category of leniency is being on the generous side to those people with a naturally weaker constitution who have more difficulty fasting or more negative results from fasting. I'm referring to pregnant women and nursing women and people of all kinds with some kind of health issue that their doctors would say you have to take your medication and it has to be with food, or you must drink because your kidneys are still compromised, or you must drink because of this reason and that reason. And it is much more leniently applicable than it would be on Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. Obviously, life-threatening situations on Yom Kippur is pushed aside, and a person can eat and drink. There are additional restrictions, if it can be done, called shiurim. And on Tisha B'Av, not even a life-threatening situation, but things less but more serious than what I described, can only exempt a person from Tisha B'Av. Anyway, the point is that Shivasar B'Tammuz, among the others, has gotten a reputation of being, quote, a minor fast, which is not really a good name for it. It's a fast day like all fast days that forbid the eating and drinking. It just has purposely built-in leniencies that don't permit eating and drinking in healthy situations, but that do allow the fast to begin at dawn and allow only eating and drinking to be prohibited, and allow these leniencies as I described. So that's Shivasar B'Tammuz, and the bottom line of Shivasar B'Tammuz is a healthy person above the age of mitzvot, 13 for a boy, 12 for a girl, through adulthood, are required to fast unless there is a compromise in their health situation, in which case their doctor needs to be consulted, and it needs to be confirmed, let's say, by one's rabbi. Now, moving on to Parshat Pinchas, we have It's a jolting, jarring, maybe that's a better word, combination and contrast between Shivasar B'Tammuz and Parshat Pinchas. First of all, today, Thursday, the Torah reading of this morning would have been the first part of Parshat Pinchas. It got preempted by the Torah reading of a fast day. Second, as we approach this Shabbat, which is only tomorrow night, we have Pinchas, which is usually within the three-week period from Shivasar B'Tammuz to Bishvat, sorry, to Tisha B'Av, from Shivasar B'Tammuz to Tisha B'Av. And in those rare occasions where it's not within that period, it's the Shabbos of the 17th of Tammuz with a fast pushed to the next day, or the Shabbat with the fast having been originally on Sunday anyway, and in one case a little bit earlier, but it's mostly associated with Shivas or B'Tammuz. And that makes it a very poignant contrast, as I mentioned, where Shivas or B'Tammuz is identified with the cessation of the Korban Tamid, and Parshat Pinchas commands Bnei Yisrael to bring the daily sacrifices. So it sort of gives you a pause to shiver, knowing that the very Sedra that we are commanded to bring, the daily sacrifices and the Musafim, matches the day that the daily sacrifices ceased. Furthermore, any of the fast days that are associated with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash are also associated with exile, being thrown out of Eretz Yisrael, being forced out of Eretz Yisrael, and that's part of what Shivas or B'Tammuz represents. The city of Jerusalem was breached, and the process continued from the siege to the breach of Jerusalem, to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and there was exile before and during and after. Contrast that with Parshat Pinchas again, because it's in Parshat Pinchas that you have the final census before the entry into the land of Israel, where the Torah, after counting, tells us that it is to these people, La'ela Techolek et Haaretz, you're going to be giving out the land of Israel. You're not going to be thrown out of Israel and go into exile. You're going to be making mass aliyah, and the land will be apportioned to you. In contrast to Shivas or B'Tammuz and the beginning of the 3 weeks. And the same thing continues into Matot Maaseh next week, a very large double portion, which is more often combined than any other pair, because there you have the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael and the issue of the settling of the 2.5 tribes on the east bank of the Jordan, and talking about Israel, 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 including one of the psukim, one of the verses that is quoted as the Torah source for the mitzvah to live in Israel, when it's during the 3 weeks, which marks not being able to live in Israel and being thrown out, or worse. So it is a very poignant situation. I'd like to play another a cappella song. This one is from a well-known musical version of the Tfila L'Chayalei Tzahal, the Mishaberach L'Chayalei Tzahal. And I am playing it, A, because it's a cappella, B, because it is in Parshat Pinchas that Moshe is given the command to gather an army to fight against Midian. That war does not take place until next week, Sedra. But it's not inappropriate when the Torah tells us that God said to Moshe, that we need to acknowledge the soon to be formed Israel army, Israelite army in those days, and the IDF, the Tzava Haganah Yisrael, the Israel Defense Forces, in our own time. With that said, here is Mishaberach L'Chayalei Tzahal.
Mishaberach Avotenu Abraham Yitzchak VeYaakov Hu Yevarech Et Chayalei Tzva Hagana
Fire! הקדוש ברוך הוא ישמור ויציל את חיילינו מכל צרה וצוקה ומכל נגע ומחלה, וישלח ברכה והצלחה בכל מעשה ידיהם, ידבר שונאינו תחתיהם, ויתרם בכתר ישועה ובעטרת ניצחון, ויקוים בהם הכתוב: כי יד השם אלוקיכם ההולך עמכם להילחם לכם עם אויביכם להושיע אתכם.
Army, since its very first battle against Amalek, through the other battles that they had before entering Eretz Yisrael, including Emori and Sichon and Og Melech HaBashan, and soon to come Midian, and after they crossed the Jordan, all of the battles that ensued in the time of and under the leadership of Yehoshua, and everything since then to this very day, when we need to be protected by God and by a true Jewish Israel army that warrants and merits God's protection and help. Okay, let's take a look into Parshat Pinchas. It is the second largest sedra, second only to Parshat Naso. But its psukim are considerably smaller on average than the rest of the Torah, even though its words average larger. And its position, its rank among psukim and words and letters fluctuates because of the imbalance in the largeness or shortness of its words, sentences, and letters. Parshat Pinchas starts with the settling of the cliffhanger from last week. Just to add, I believe there are two sedras that end in the old-fashioned kind of cliffhanger, where you can hear the announcer say, stay tuned next week, same time, same station, and find out what happened to, and then they break to a commercial. The first one was the end of Parshat Miketz, where Yosef and his sent his brothers back to back to their father with supplies and with money, and then had planted his special silver chalice in the sack of Binyamin, sent his corps of guards to find out who took it, and at the end of Miketz, it's a very nerve-wracking situation where Yehuda offers himself instead of Binyamin, and Yosef, still unknown to them, says no, the only one that's guilty is the one who stole the cup, even though he had framed Binyamin for it. And it's only at the beginning of Vayigash where we see the clash between Yosef and Yehuda, and the revelation of Yehuda, that of Yosef identifying himself, and the rest of the story. Similarly, at the end of last week's Sedra of Bullock, or of Chukat Bullock if you're in Chutz Laretz, we had a situation where men from Israel, from the Israelites, were enticed and seduced into the orgiastic worship of Baal Peor by Midianite women and Moabite women. And in God's anger at that, a plague broke out and started killing Jews. Pinchas took a spear and skewered both the man from Shevet Shimon, later we find out this week's Sedra that he was Zimri, and the woman who is identified in this week's Sedra as Cosbi Vatsur. And the Sedra ends with the Magefa of 24,000 people so far dead stopping. But we don't know yet what's going to happen with Pinchas. We have sources that tell us that the tribe of Shimon led an angry mob that wanted to kill Pinchas for killing their leader. And it was a very, very thin line as to whether Pinchas was justified or not justified. In the beginning of this week's Sedra of Pinchas, we first hear him identified as Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen, and that Yichus is purposely put there to counter the taunting of other tribes who called him Pinchas ben Puti because his mother came from Midian, actually. So, and then God, thanking Pinchas, so to speak, for jealously and zealously guarding God's honor, and gave him Briti Shalom, covenant of peace, and Brit Kuhunat Olam. So that officially settled the question mark over Pinchas' head. Then you have the pasuk I referred to before, where God commands Moshe to form an army and fight against Midian, and then the Sedra goes into the census, which would be necessary for forming that army, and it describes in detail each of the tribes and each of the family names that came from the tribes and how many people they had, and that is a major portion of Parshat Pinchas. During that time, after Moshe announces that the land will be apportioned to these people who are the heirs of the generation who came out of Egypt, five women named Mahla, Chogla, Milka, Tirza, and Noah, that's not the order, but I just was reciting them, They are known as Benot Tzolofchad, the daughters of Tzolofchad. And they come before Moshe and Aharon and the people, and they say, we have no brothers, and our father, who died in the Midbar, was not part of Korach's rebellion, where he would forfeit his claim to any property as a Moreid B'malchut. But he died for other reasons, and his father died as well. And both of them, both our father Tzolofchad and our grandfather Chefer, had been over 20 years old when they came out of Egypt, and their heirs were due a share in Eretz Yisrael. So it's not fair that we should lose it because we weren't counted as part of this census, because it only counted men of military age. We want to share in Eretz Yisrael as well. Moshe turned to God to clarify the issue, and the famous Kain Benot Tzolofchad Dovrot, the daughters of Tzolofchad truly speak correctly, and the laws of inheritance are set down. A man is inherited by his sons, if there are no sons, by his daughters, if there are no children at all, by his father, and if he's not alive, by his brothers. And if no brothers around to do, then his sisters. And if no sisters or brothers, no siblings, then his uncles. And it keeps going on and on like that, by setting down the laws of inheritance, which the Rambam counts as a single mitzvah in the Torah, and Ramban counts the requirement of giving a double portion to the firstborn as a separate mitzvah, the prohibition of taking away an inheritance, and the prohibition of taking away the double portion from the Bechor as separate prohibitions. One way or the other, however you count the mitzvot, this is the original source of the laws of inheritance, called in Hebrew, Dine Nechalot. Okay, now the Torah switches to the psukim that I referred to before of the daily korbanot, and that constitutes one of the 613 mitzvot, obligating Klal Yisrael as a unit. This is not an individual thing. This is a mitzvah for all of Israel, represented by their Sanhedrin and represented by the Kohanim who function in the Beit HaMikdash, to bring a daily korban in the morning and another one in the afternoon. That is followed by the Musaf of Shabbat. Now, once we start with the Musaf of Shabbat, we have to realize that our tefillot, our prayers of evening, ma'ariv, shacharit, in the morning, and mincha in the afternoon, the Gemara tells us, are a combination of being originated by the Avot, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Avram Shacharit, and their psukim to support that, Yitzchak Mincha, and their psukim to support that, and Yaakov Ma'ariv, and their psukim to support that. But they also correspond to the timing of the Korbanot and the Beit HaMikdash, the morning Tamid, the afternoon Tamid, and the simmering of parts from the day's Korban on the Mizbeach all night. When it comes to Musaf, our Tfilat Musaf is temporarily instead of the Korbanot Musaf that were brought in the Beit HaMikdash. When we have a new Beit HaMikdash and we restore the Korbanot Musaf, does that mean we stop davening? I don't think so. I'm talking about Musaf. We certainly don't stop the other davenings. Maybe Musaf we will, or maybe Musaf will be just reworded for the reality at the time. So you have a mitzvah. The first mitzvah is laws of inheritance. You have a positive mitzvah of bringing the daily Tamidim. You have a positive mitzvah of bringing the Musaf of Shabbat. You have a positive mitzvah of bringing Korban Musaf, which also consists of a sin offering, a communal sin offering, and that's a separate mitzvah. You do not have counted here the mitzvah of Korbanot on the Yom Tov of Pesach, because they've already been counted back in Parsha Nemar. You do have the mitzvah to bring Korbanot on Shavuot, because they were not discussed back in Parshat Emor. Different Korbanot were discussed. You don't have Rosh Hashanah, you don't have Yom Kippur, and you don't have Sukkot, because they are already counted as mitzvot earlier. What you do have related to Rosh Hashanah, which is not found earlier, is the mitzvah to blow shofar. I just want to give you a little bit of an overview on this, because coming up to Rosh Hashanah, Emir Tzashem will talk more about it. But basically, the Torah does not say, you shall blow shofar. It doesn't even say, you shall hear the shofar being blown. It commands it in the written word in a very oblique manner of Yom Teruah Yihyeh Lachem. You shall have a Teruah day. The question is obvious. What's a Teruah day? And Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral Torah, tells us what a Teruah day is. And it tells us that it is... One second. It tells us that a Teruah day is the day that you shall hear the sounding of the shofar. How does the Gemara teach that to us? Not to have to go into it now, by a process called Gezeir Shava to the shofar of Yom Kippur of Yovel, where shofar is mentioned in association with the Teruah, and it's taught by oral law that that's the meaning of Yom Teruah Yihyeh Lachem. The question that remains is, why did God choose to command the listening to the sound of the shofar in an oblique way? That we have to have the oral law tell us with a method as to how it was derived by God's law from Yovel. Why couldn't it have said, blow the shofar, or hear the shofar? And I believe the answer is very important. If we were told, you shall blow the shofar, or you shall hear the shofar, the reason I keep saying both of those is because the mitzvah is lishmoa kol shofar, to hear the sound of the shofar, and the blowing is just the technicality by which people are able to hear it. But you still say in mitzvah to blow shofar. It's a mitzvah to hear the blowing of the shofar. If that were the command, then we would be able to fulfill that mitzvah with the physical, sensational experience of hearing the sounds of the shofar with our ears. And that is shortchanging what the shofar is supposed to do. The shofar is supposed to be that which turns our day of Rosh Hashanah into a Yom Teruah. How does it do that? It does it by the sounds of the shofar. It does it by the davening that we have on that day. It does it by the weaving of shofar blasts with the special Musaf Brachot of Rosh Hashanah. It even includes things like Tashlich and how you spend your meal and the full Rosh Hashanah experience is supposed to be coordinated, so to speak, into a Yom Teruah, which the Torah can command only in that oblique way, rather than the simpler, straightforward, blow the shofar. I just give you another example so you know that I'm not stum making it up to answer the question here, because it occurs in other places also. The Rambam, Maimonides, says, there's a mitzvah taseh in the Torah to pray every day, Shene'emar ul avdo b'chol levavchem, and you shall serve him, God, with all of your heart. Then the Rambam continues that and says, Ezohi avodah shebalev, what is service of the heart? Zohi tefillah. That's davening. Again, the Torah does not say, you shall daven, you shall pray. it says you shall serve God with all your heart, which means, by our tradition, prayer. And the answer should be obvious here, especially based on what I already said about shofar. The answer here is that mumbling the prayers or even reciting them word for word carefully is not the whole picture of prayer. It is not even half of the picture of prayer, because prayer is service of God in one's heart. And for that, you need to understand the prayers, and you need to personalize them and internalize them and bring them from your ear, from your mouth, via your ear, to your brain, to your heart and your soul. So I believe that's with tefillah, and I believe that is with shofar, and there are probably a few other examples as well. Now, going back for a moment to the reference I made to the bracha for shofar, lishmoa kol shofar, not litkoa ba shofar, not to blow the shofar, but to hear the sound of the shofar. The word lishmoa is a complicated word. Lishmoa and all of the words related to it, like shema, are more than hearing. They are also understanding what you hear. The analogy that I like to give is to a guy standing at a crosswalk waiting to cross the street. Immediately to his right is a large truck about to back up. When the driver of the truck puts the car into reverse and this fellow is about to step onto the crosswalk, the truck emits a beeping sound. Beep, 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 beep. If the guy continues walking, imagine the driver slamming on the brakes just in time, getting out, slamming his door, and saying, "What's the matter with you? Didn't you hear the beeps?" And he could say, "You know, I did hear the beeps. I just didn't understand what they meant." And that's just as bad as not hearing them. You can't hear the sound of the shofar on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah, sorry, without understanding what each sound represents and the connection to the prayers that we say and the events that it commemorates, like Akedat Yitzchak and Ma'amad Har Sinai and building of the Beit HaMikdash and all kind of things. And these, the psukim, the verses that we recite in the tefillah and the passages, help us understand. But the mitzvah is really lishmoa, more than hearing, understanding. And that is an explanation of the pasuk, which we say right after the blowing of the first bunch of kolot. Ashrei ha'am yodei trua. Fortunate and happy are the people who know the shofar, who know the trua sound of the shofar, not who hear the sound of the shofar. You need more than just hearing. You need understanding and personalizing so it gets down to your heart and soul as well. On that note, we will finish this show of Torah Tidbits Audio. I will finish with my traditional farewell. But before that, I will tell you that the song that we'll play after is also an a cappella piece that I got from mostlymusic.com. It was one of the free offerings there, and I recommend, whether you want to buy something or download some free music, it's there, mostlymusic.com. Very nice website. And I will wish you the rest of the fast day to be meaningful to you. And if it's already after the fast is over that you're listening to these words, I hope that you will take them as an introduction to the three-week period, which is not over yet. It's just beginning. And There are a lot of little things about the 3 weeks that we could talk about next week in Mirtz Hashem. And for now, I wish you Shabbat Shalom, L'hish Tamea.
Rachamanu yachzir lanu avoidas beis hamigdash. Rachamanu yachzir lanu avoidas beis hamigdash. Limkoyimo, limkoyimo. Rachamanu yachzir lanu avoidas beis hamigdash. Rachamanu yachzir lanu avoidas beis hamigdash. Limkoyimo, limkoyimo. Imo lele koimo dim hero yo me you know oh me in a cello dim hero yo me you know oh me in a cello dim hero yo la 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 la
Rachamanu yachzir lanu avoidas beis hamigdash. Nekoima, nekoima, limekoima. Rachamanu yachzir lanu avoidas beis hamigdash. Rachamanu yachzir lanu avoidas beis hamigdash. Limekoima, limekoima, limekoima.
La 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 la